From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a moment, President Bush will step to a podium at the Army War College in Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, to deliver a speech he hopes will persuade America and the world he has a plan to bring stability to Iraq. We will bring you that speech live and uninterrupted, followed by analysis and your calls. With an ongoing insurgency and nearly 800 American soldiers dead since the U.S. invasion of Iraq last spring, the president has been put on the defensive. Tonight, aides say he hopes to clarify plans for handing over power to Iraqis on June 30th, just 5 weeks from now. The details of that handover and the makeup of a new Iraqi government are being hammered out now in Iraq by U.N. envoy Lakhdar Brahimi. The Bush White House handed that job to the U.N. after its own efforts met with resistance and a series of failures and scrambles to regroup. President Bush has a lot riding on restoring the confidence of Americans in his handling of Iraq. His approval ratings in national polling have fallen to an all-time low. The president hopes to rebuild confidence in his speech tonight, the first in a series of speeches the White House says he will deliver before June 30th. The effort comes none too soon. Over the weekend, Republican Senator Richard Lugar, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, faulted President Bush for having failed to offer solid plans for Iraq's future. We bring you President Bush. A crowd of professors at the Army War College. Standing welcome.
Thank you all.
For President Bush.
Thank you and good evening. I'm honored to visit the Army War College. Generations of officers have come here to study the strategies and history of warfare. I've come here tonight to report to all Americans and to the Iraqi people on the strategy our nation is pursuing in Iraq and the specific steps we're taking to achieve our goals. The actions of our enemies over the last few weeks have been brutal, calculating, and instructive. We've seen a car bombing take the life of a 61-year-old Iraqi named Izzadeen Salim, who was serving as president of the governing council. This crime shows our enemy's intention to prevent Iraqi self-government, even if that means killing a lifelong Iraqi patriot and a faithful Muslim. Mr. Salim was assassinated by terrorists seeking the return of tyranny and the death of democracy. We've also seen images of a young American facing decapitation. This vile display shows a contempt for all the rules of warfare and all the bounds of civilized behavior. It reveals a fanaticism that was not caused by any action of ours and would not be appeased by any concession. We suspect that the man with the knife was an Al-Qaeda associate named Zarqawi. He and other terrorists know that Iraq is now the central front in the war on terror. And we must understand that as well. The return of tyranny to Iraq would be an unprecedented terrorist victory and a cause for killers to rejoice. It would also embolden the terrorists, leading to more bombings, more beheadings, and more murders of the innocent around the world. The rise of a free and self-governing Iraq will deny terrorists a base of operation, discredit their narrow ideology, and give momentum to reformers across the region. This will be a decisive blow to terrorism at the heart of its power and a victory for the security of America and the civilized world. Our work in Iraq has been hard. Our coalition has faced changing conditions of war And that has required perseverance, sacrifice, and an ability to adapt. The swift removal of Saddam Hussein's regime last spring had an unintended effect. Instead of being killed or captured on the battlefield, some of Saddam's elite guards shed their uniforms and melted into the civilian population. These elements of Saddam's repressive regime and secret police have reorganized, rearmed, and adopted sophisticated terrorist tactics. They've linked up with foreign fighters and terrorists. In a few cities, extremists have tried to sow chaos and seize regional power for themselves. These groups and individuals have conflicting ambitions, but they share a goal. They hope to wear out the patience of Americans, our coalition, and Iraqis before the arrival of effective self-government and before Iraqis have the capability to defend their freedom. Iraq now faces a critical moment. As the Iraqi people move closer to governing themselves, the terrorists are likely to become more active and more brutal. There are difficult days ahead, and the way forward may sometimes appear chaotic. Yet our coalition is strong. Our efforts are focused and unrelenting, and no power of the enemy will stop Iraq's progress. Helping construct a stable democracy after decades of dictatorship is a massive undertaking. Yet we have a great advantage. Whenever people are given a choice in the matter, they prefer lives of freedom to lives of fear. Our enemies in Iraq are good at filling hospitals, but they don't build any. They can incite men to murder and suicide, but they cannot inspire men to live and hope, and add to the progress of their country. The terrorists' only influence is violence, and their only agenda is death. Our agenda, in contrast, is freedom and independence, security and prosperity for the Iraqi people. And by removing a source of terrorist violence and instability in the Middle East, we also make our own country more secure. Our coalition has a clear goal, understood by all, to see the Iraqi people in charge of Iraq for the first time in generations. America's task in Iraq is not only to defeat an enemy, it is to give strength to a friend, a free, representative government that serves its people and fights on their behalf. And the sooner this goal is achieved, the sooner our job will be done. There are five steps in our plan to help Iraq achieve democracy and freedom. We will hand over authority to a sovereign Iraqi government, help establish security, continue rebuilding Iraq's infrastructure, encourage more international support, and move toward a national election that will bring forward new leaders empowered by the Iraqi people. The first of these steps will occur next month when our coalition will transfer full sovereignty to a government of Iraqi citizens who will prepare the way for national elections. On June 30th, the coalition provisional authority will cease to exist and will not be replaced. The occupation will end, and Iraqis will govern their own affairs. America's ambassador to Iraq, John Negroponte, will present his credentials to the new president of Iraq. Our embassy in Baghdad will have the same purpose as any other American embassy, to assure good relations with a sovereign nation. America and other countries will continue to provide technical experts to help Iraq's ministries of government, but these ministries will report to Iraq's new prime minister. the United Nations Special Envoy Lakhdar Brahimi, is now consulting with a broad spectrum of Iraqis to determine the composition of this interim government. The Special Envoy intends to put forward the names of interim government officials this week. In addition to a president, two vice presidents, and a prime minister, 26 Iraqi ministers will oversee government departments from health to justice to defense. This new government will be advised by a national council, which will be chosen in July by Iraqis representing their country's diversity. This interim government will exercise full sovereignty until national elections are held. America fully supports Mr. Brahimi's efforts, and I have instructed the Coalition Provisional Authority to assist him in every way possible. In preparation for sovereignty, many functions of government have already been transferred. 12 government ministries are currently under the direct control of Iraqis. The Ministry of Education, for example, is out of the propaganda business and is now concerned with educating Iraqi children. Under the direction of Dr. Aladan Al-Awan, the ministry has trained more than 30,000 teachers and supervisors for the schools of a new Iraq. All along, some have questioned whether the Iraqi people are ready for self-government or want it. And all along, the Iraqi people have given their answers. In settings where Iraqis have met to discuss their country's future, they have endorsed representative government. And they are practicing representative government. Many of Iraq's cities and towns now have elected town councils and city governments. And beyond the violence, a civil society is emerging. The June 30th transfer of sovereignty is an essential commitment of our strategy. Iraqis are proud people who resent foreign control of their affairs, just as we would. After decades under the tyrant, they're also reluctant to trust authority. By keeping our promise on June 30th, the coalition will demonstrate that we have no interest in occupation. And full sovereignty will give Iraqis a direct interest in the success of their own government. Iraqis will know that when they build a school or repair a bridge, they're not working for the Coalition Provisional Authority. They're working for themselves. And when they patrol the streets of Baghdad or engage radical militias, they will be fighting for their own country. The second step in the plan for Iraqi democracy is to help establish the stability and security that democracy requires. Coalition forces and the Iraqi people have the same enemies: the terrorists, illegal militia, and Saddam loyalists, who stand between the Iraqi people and their future as a free nation. Working as allies, we will defend Iraq and defeat these enemies. America will provide forces and support necessary for achieving these goals. Our commanders had estimated that a troop level below 115,000 would be sufficient at this point in the conflict. Given the recent increase in violence, we will maintain our troop level at the current 138,000 as long as necessary. This has required extended duty for the 1st Armored Division and the 2nd Light Cavalry Regiment, 20,000 men and women who were scheduled to leave Iraq in April. Our nation appreciates their hard work and sacrifice, and they can know that they will be heading home soon. General Abizaid and other commanders in Iraq are constantly assessing the level of troops they need to fulfill the mission. If they need more troops, I will send them. The mission of our forces in Iraq is demanding and dangerous. Our troops are showing exceptional skill and courage. I thank them for their sacrifices and their duty. In the city of Fallujah, there has been considerable violence by Saddam loyalists and foreign fighters, including the murder of four American contractors. American soldiers and Marines could have used overwhelming force. Our commanders, however, consulted with Iraq's governing council and local officials and determined that massive strikes against the enemy would alienate the local population and increase support for the insurgency. So we have pursued a different approach. We're making security a shared responsibility in Fallujah. Coalition commanders have worked with local leaders to create an all-Iraqi security force, which is now patrolling the city. Our soldiers and Marines will continue to disrupt enemy attacks on our supply routes, conduct joint patrols with Iraqis to destroy bomb factories and safe houses, and kill or capture any enemy. We want Iraqi forces to gain experience and confidence in dealing with their country's enemies. We want the Iraqi people to know that we trust their growing capabilities, even as we help build them. At the same time, Fallujah must cease to be a sanctuary for the enemy, and those responsible for terrorism will be held to account. In the cities of Najaf and Karbala and Kufa, most of the violence has been incited by a young radical cleric who commands an illegal militia. These enemies have been hiding behind an innocent civilian population, storing arms and ammunition in mosques, and launching attacks from holy shrines. Our soldiers have treated religious sites with respect while systematically dismantling the illegal militia. We're also seeing Iraqis themselves take more responsibility for restoring order. In recent weeks, Iraqi forces have ejected elements of this militia from the governor's office in Najaf. Yesterday, an elite Iraqi unit cleared out a weapons cache from a large mosque in Kufa. Respected Shia leaders have called on the militia to withdraw from these towns. Ordinary Iraqis have marched in protest against the militants. As challenges rise in Fallujah, Najaf, and elsewhere, the tactics of our military will be flexible. Commanders on the ground will pay close attention to local conditions. And we will do all that is necessary by measured force or overwhelming force to achieve a stable Iraq. Iraq's military, police, and border forces have begun to take on broader responsibilities. Eventually, they must be the primary defenders of Iraqi security as American and coalition forces are withdrawn. And we're helping them to prepare for this role. In some cases, the early performance of Iraqi forces fell short. Some refused orders to engage the enemy. We've learned from these failures, and we've taken steps to correct them. Successful fighting units need a sense of cohesion, so we've lengthened and intensified their training. Successful units need to know they are fighting for the future of their own country, not for any occupying power. So we are ensuring that Iraqi forces serve under an Iraqi chain of command. Successful fighting units need the best possible leadership, so we improve the vetting and training of Iraqi officers and senior enlisted men. In my direction and with the support of Iraqi authorities, we are accelerating our program to help train Iraqis to defend their country. A new team of senior military officers is now assessing every unit in Iraq's security forces. I've asked this team to oversee the training of a force of 260,000 Iraqi soldiers, police, and other security personnel. Five Iraqi army battalions are in the field now, with another eight battalions to join them by July the 1st. The eventual goal is an Iraqi army of 35,000 soldiers in 27 battalions, fully prepared to defend their country. After June 30th, American and other forces will still have important duties. American military forces in Iraq will operate under American command as a part of a multinational force authorized by the United Nations. Iraq's new sovereign government will still face enormous security challenges, and our forces will be there to help. The third step in the plan for Iraqi democracy is to continue rebuilding that nation's infrastructure so that a free Iraq can quickly gain economic independence and a better quality of life. Our coalition has already helped Iraqis to rebuild schools and refurbish hospitals and health clinics, repair bridges, upgrade the electrical grid, and modernize the communication system. And now a growing private economy is taking shape. A new currency has been introduced. Iraq's Governing Council approved a new law that opens the country to foreign investment for the first time in decades. Iraq has liberalized its trade policy, and today an Iraqi observer attends meetings of the World Trade Organization. Iraqi oil production has reached more than 2 million barrels per day, bringing revenues of nearly $6 billion so far this year, which is being used to help the people of Iraq. And thanks in part to our efforts, to the efforts of former Secretary of State James Baker, many of Iraq's largest creditors have pledged to forgive or substantially reduce Iraqi debt incurred by the former regime. We're making progress, yet there still is much work to do. Over the decades of Saddam's rule, Iraq's infrastructure was allowed to crumble, while money was diverted to palaces and to wars and to weapons programs. We're urging other nations to contribute to Iraqi reconstruction. And 37 countries and the IMF and the World Bank have so far pledged $13.5 billion in aid. America has dedicated more than $20 billion to reconstruction and development projects in Iraq. To ensure our money is spent wisely and effectively, our new embassy in Iraq will have regional offices in several key cities. These offices will work closely with Iraqis at all levels of government to help make sure projects are completed on time and on budget. A new Iraq will also need a humane, well-supervised prison system. Under the dictator, prisons like Abu Ghraib were symbols of death and torture. That same prison became a symbol of disgraceful conduct by a few American troops who dishonored our country and disregarded our values. America will fund the construction of a modern maximum security prison. When that prison is completed, detainees at Abu Ghraib will be relocated. Then, with the approval of the Iraqi government, we will demolish the Abu Ghraib prison as a fitting symbol of Iraq's new beginning. The fourth step in our plan is to enlist additional international support for Iraq's transition. At every stage, the United States has gone to the United Nations to confront Saddam Hussein, to promise serious consequences for his actions, and to begin Iraqi reconstruction. Today, the United States and Great Britain presented a new resolution in the Security Council to help move Iraq toward self-government. I've directed Secretary Powell to work with fellow members of the Council to endorse the timetable the Iraqis have adopted, to express international support for Iraq's interim government, to reaffirm the world's security commitment to the Iraqi people, and to encourage other UN members to join in the effort. Despite past disagreements, most nations have indicated strong support for the success of a free Iraq. And I'm confident they will share in the responsibility of assuring that success. Next month at the NATO summit in Istanbul, I will thank our 15 NATO allies who together have more than 17,000 troops on the ground in Iraq. Great Britain and Poland are each leading a multinational division that is securing important parts of the country. And NATO itself is giving helpful intelligence and communications and logistical support to the Polish-led division. At the summit, we will discuss NATO's role in helping Iraq build and secure its democracy. The fifth and most important step is free national elections to be held no later than next January. A United Nations team headed by Karina Pirelli is now in Iraq, helping form an independent election commission that will oversee an orderly, accurate national election. In that election, the Iraqi people will choose a transitional national assembly, the first freely elected, truly representative national governing body in Iraq's history. This assembly will serve as Iraq's legislature, and it will choose a transitional government with executive powers. The transitional national assembly will also draft a new constitution, which will be presented to the Iraqi people in a referendum scheduled for the fall of 2005. Under this new constitution, Iraq will elect a permanent government by the end of next year. In this time of war and liberation and rebuilding, American soldiers and civilians on the ground have come to know and respect the citizens of Iraq. They're proud people who hold strong and diverse opinions. Yet Iraqis are united in a broad and deep conviction. They're determined never again to live at the mercy of a dictator. And they believe that a national election will put that dark time behind them. A representative government that protects basic rights, elected by Iraqis, is the best defense against the return of tyranny. And that election is coming. Completing the five steps to Iraqi elected self-government will not be easy. There is likely to be more violence before the transfer of sovereignty and after the transfer of sovereignty. The terrorists and Saddam loyalists would rather see many Iraqis die than have any live in freedom. But terrorists will not determine the future of Iraq. That nation is moving every week toward free elections and a permanent place among free nations. Like every nation that has made the journey to democracy, Iraqis will raise up a government that reflects their own culture and values. I sent American troops to Iraq to defend our security, not to stay as an occupying power. I sent American troops to Iraq to make its people free, not to make them American. Iraqis will write their own history and find their own way. As they do, Iraqis can be certain. A free Iraq will always have a friend in the United States of America. In the last 32 months, history has placed great demands on our country, and events have come quickly. Americans have seen the flames of September the 11th, followed battles in the mountains of Afghanistan, and learned new terms like Orange Alert and Ricin and Dirty Bomb. We've seen killers at work on trains in Madrid, in a bank in Istanbul, at a synagogue in Tunis, and at a nightclub in Bali. And now the families of our soldiers and civilian workers pray for their sons and daughters in Mosul and Karbala and Baghdad. We did not seek this war on terror, but this is the world as we find it. We must keep our focus. We must do our duty. History is moving, and it will tend toward hope or tend toward tragedy. Our terrorist enemies have a vision that guides and explains all their varied acts of murder. They seek to impose Taliban-like rule, country by country, across the greater Middle East. They seek the total control of every person and mind and soul. A harsh society in which women are voiceless and brutalized. They seek bases of operation to train more killers and export more violence. They commit dramatic acts of murder to shock, frighten, and demoralize civilized nations, hoping we will retreat from the world and give them free rein. They seek weapons of mass destruction to impose their will through blackmail and catastrophic attacks. None of this is the expression of a religion. It is a totalitarian political ideology pursued with consuming zeal and without conscience. Our actions, too, are guided by a vision. We believe that freedom can advance and change lives in the greater Middle East, as it has advanced and changed lives in Asia and Latin America and Eastern Europe and Africa. We believe it is a tragedy of history that in the Middle East, which gave the world great gifts of law and science and faith, so many have been held back by lawless tyranny and fanaticism. We believe that when all Middle Eastern peoples are finally allowed to live and think and work and worship as free men and women, they will reclaim the greatness of their own heritage. And when that day comes, the bitterness and burning hatreds that feed terrorism will fade and die away. America and all the world will be safer when hope has returned to the Middle East. These two visions, one of tyranny and murder, the other of liberty and life, clashed in Afghanistan. And thanks to brave U.S. and coalition forces and to Afghan patriots, the nightmare of the Taliban is over, and that nation is coming to life again. These two visions have now met in Iraq and are contending for the future of that country. The failure of freedom would only mark the beginning of peril and violence. But my fellow Americans, we will not fail. We will persevere and defeat this enemy and hold this hard-won ground for the realm of liberty. May God bless our country.
President Bush speaking this evening in Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, at the Army War College, before an audience of green-clad Army officers, the faculty of the Army War College. President dressed in his suit and tie, not in any kind of military garb himself tonight. He's being approached now and congratulatory shaking hands with officers in the hall. President stepping up tonight after a very difficult patch in Iraq to speak to his vision for the future of that country, the plans that he hopes to see unfold there in the coming weeks, saying that there are five steps to his plan: handing over authority to a sovereign Iraqi government, that's scheduled for June 30th, establishing security, and in that interest, he said that U.S. troops will stay at the 138,000 man or troop level as long as necessary. No end date there. Continuing to rebuild Iraq's infrastructure will be a priority, he said, along with encouraging more international support. The United States has gone to the UN Security Council just in the last day and a half, looking for a new resolution that would sanction the post-June 30th government there, a UN sanction, that is. And he said, most importantly, the U.S. will work to move Iraq toward national elections that, quote, will bring forward new leaders empowered by the Iraqi people. President saying tonight, we will persevere and defeat this enemy, that is terrorism. And he once again fully equated opposition in Iraq with international terrorism, Islamist terrorism. We will persevere and defeat this enemy, he said, and hold this hard-won ground for the realm of liberty. And sticking with his vision of Iraq as a jumping-off platform for further democracy in the Middle East, he said, we believe that freedom can advance and change lives in the greater Middle East. A very important speech for the president tonight, the first of a series of speeches we are told that he will deliver in the run-up to the June 30th handover of sovereignty, full sovereignty as he defined it tonight, in Iraq. Much on the line for the president tonight, and we're looking forward to hearing your response to the speech you've just heard. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Did you hear a reassuring message in the president's speech tonight? Has President Bush bolstered your confidence in U.S. efforts in Iraq, or at least persuaded you that the U.S. must remain in Iraq to see it through to a free, independent government? Are you inspired by the president's vision for Iraq? Are you on board? Do you see a different way, a better way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I am happy and fortunate to be joined tonight to look back on the president's remarks and their implications from Washington, D.C., by Lawrence Korb, who was with us in the hour before, has listened to the president's speech, and has now returned to join us. Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration from 1981 to 85, and now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Lawrence Korb, glad you're back.
Nice to be back.
And also from Washington, E.J. Dionne, syndicated columnist for the Washington Post and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. E.J. Dionne, wonderful to have you tonight.
Good to be with you and with Larry Korb.
Larry Korb, we spoke before the president's speech. All kinds of concern and misgivings about what's going on in Iraq. The president steps to the podium and in most regards has a steady as she goes message for Americans and Iraqis here.
Well, he does. But, you know, it's interesting. I would hope that he would have read the Army War College study that says the problem is that, to use their term, you conflated the war in Iraq with the war against terrorism, which he did again tonight. We could get out of Iraq without, in fact, undermining the war against the Al-Qaeda. But, you know, he lumped them all, and this is all part of one struggle. And in fact, it's something completely different. But I think he was trying to make the point that if you fail there, then the whole war against Al-Qaeda is lost, when, in fact, that's not true. And he also resurrected the old sort of domino theory that if we can make Iraq a democracy, it'll spread all throughout, as he called it, the greater Middle East. I wonder what the Egyptians and the Saudis, of people with whom we deal with all the time, were thinking when they heard that. And then finally, we're not what we're giving on June 30th is some control, but it's not sovereignty. If it were sovereignty, then the Iraqis could, determine the rules of engagement for American military, which is clear that he's not going to let them do.
Colin Powell has said, E.J. Dionne, that if an Iraqi government would ask the U.S. troops to leave, they would do that. But as Larry Korb says, no control over rules of engagement. Your overall sense of the president in his speech before this audience tonight, E.J. Dionne, how is he responding to the blows of the last few weeks, and what do you hear?
Well, I was trying to listen to the speech as best I could, and I don't pretend I'm the person I'm about to describe, as either a moderate Republican voter or an independent voter, mm-hmm. because you've had all these polls come out today and the last couple of days, which show the president in a lot of trouble, and he's in a lot of trouble because he really hasn't solidified that part of the Republican Party that is not very conservative and very loyal to him, and he's doing very badly among independents. And I think their doubts about the administration are rooted not in ideology, but in a sense of, do these guys know what they're doing? There's great doubt about our policy because it looks to most of us like a mess over there. The Abu Ghraib prison business is not only something that makes Americans look terrible in the eyes of the rest of the world, but people ask the question, how did this happen? And so I kept trying to listen to the speech, is this reassuring that we know where we're going? And what the president did instead of providing a new direction for policy was to appeal to certain sentiments that most Americans share. I was struck, as Larry was, by his kind of melding together the victory over the Taliban with what's going on in Iraq. He attacked a totalitarian political ideology, he said, of Afghanistan. The nightmare of the Taliban is over. But it wasn't clear to me that he said, here are the steps we're going to take to make this work. Here are the steps we're going to take that will eventually allow us to leave. And the other line that really struck me that you could imagine appearing in a commercial in the fall was, and I think I got this right, the way forward may sometimes appear chaotic. Mm-hmm. Well, chaos is not what Americans either expected or want out of this policy. So I suspect that those who are strongly committed to this policy were reinforced by what the president said. Those who were opposed to it were not persuaded. But I'm not clear he said anything tonight to speak to that middle that seems to be moving away from him at the moment.
But Larry Korb, the president does, though, set up a kind of logic here that says, once again, we must win in Iraq for the sake of the Iraqis, that they might be more free, for the future of the Middle East, that it might become more democratic, and for, in his presentation, the security of the United States, because if we do not, this will become a super breeding ground for international terrorism. Speak to that on two counts, on its accuracy in terms of a description of global security circumstances, and your sense of its political effectiveness. Is it not hard to resist that logic line if you're sitting somewhere out there in the great United States listening to your president speak?
Well, I think the third one is the key one. I mean, whether you supported us going into Iraq or didn't, we went in. And I think if we leave Iraq and it becomes like Afghanistan after we pulled out after the Soviets left, it could become a breeding ground for terrorism. And since we didn't put enough troops in there, among other things, to guard the borders, there have been foreign fighters come in, and they will feel that they've driven us out. So he's put us in this bind that will endanger our security if we don't handle it correctly. The real question is, will the American people continue to pay the cost for this, both in terms of lives and money, if they don't see this situation getting under control? I mean, how much patience will they have? Because I think, as EJ mentioned, yes, he reinforced his base, but the opinion polls show that the majority of the Americans don't think the whole thing was a good idea now.
And the president not offering really any relief on that front tonight, essentially saying there's no burden too great and no duration too long for this effort, essentially saying we'll go the distance, whatever that distance may be. Let's hear from some of those Americans who would like to join our conversation. James is calling from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, a couple points. Whether democracy will ever succeed in Iraq, my own personal opinion is no. The reason is that those people over there have never had a democracy. They've always been ruled by a dictator. And the ones that are trying to rule them now are the three major religious groups, the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Sunnis. They all want a piece of the pie, and they all want the majority of the pie. As far as Mr. Bush claiming to wanting to reduce the number of troops over there, that is a lie also, because he is pulling 3,600 troops out of South Korea within the next 2 months, and he is shipping them to Iraq. The reason I know this is because my son is one of them.
Heading from Korea to Iraq.
Yes.
God bless you, sir. Good luck.
Yeah, we hope your son does well, James. We hear the lack of confidence in your voice there tonight, but thanks for calling. I should point out, it is true, Lawrence Korb, as you described, the Army War College, where the president was pretty warmly received tonight, though I must say his biggest applause came for not his description of his plans for Iraq, but his praise for U.S. troops and their stick-to-itiveness there, and also for his promise to demolish the prison at Abu Ghraib, where the abuses, torture, call it what you will, occurred last year and early this year. But the Army War College has come out with two reports, the first one in January, saying the war in Iraq was unnecessary and a detour that has diverted attention and resources from the threat posed by al-Qaeda. And then again, just last month, a report severely criticizing the Bush administration's preparations for attacking Iraq, saying, quote, the logic of war was flawed by by a belief that the U.S. could, quote, win the war quickly and on the cheap. E.J. Dionne, his audience tonight is a uniformed audience, though not all necessarily active duty, I guess, at the Army War College. Is the military likely to find reassurance in the president's stirring phrases here?
Well, you know, I was struck by how little applause there was for long part of the speech, and as you said, he didn't get really strong applause until he praised our troops, which I think all of us would applaud for, and then for the destruction of the prison. And there you have to ask the question, this would have been a really good idea about a year or a year and a half ago. And it's one of those ideas that's now been floating around since these awful reports about what went on in it. And so that looks a little like too little, too late.
Better late than never, or destroying the evidence.
Destroying the prison. Mm-hmm. In other words, the notion that we as Americans just took over Saddam's prison went utterly against what we were going in there to do, which was to destroy this brutal dictatorship. But to go to the call of the gentleman, and again, I wish his son good luck. Thanks for his service. The notion of transforming a dictatorship to a democracy, that's not an impossible idea. I mean, the Portuguese were under a dictatorship for a very long time and became a democracy. The same thing happened in Spain. That's at least possible. But I do think the caller was absolutely right that you are dealing with a situation here where you really have three countries drawn into one. It's almost like one of those weird redistricting plans that we've seen all around the country for congressional seats.
The Sunni, Shia, and Kurds.
Exactly. And that I think it's going to be very difficult to construct the kind of federal democracy I think you'll need for the Shia, the Kurds, and the Sunnis to live together. By Peter Galbraith, an old friend of mine who was our ambassador to Croatia.
Yes, who we heard from last hour.
Oh, good. And, you know, his suggestion that you want a very weak kind of federal system, weak in the sense that you have a lot of authority in different parts of Iraq, looks more and more appealing. But I'm not sure we have the capacity to pull that off. I think the difficulty is we made a very big promise here, which is that our power can transform this country into a workable democracy. Whatever we do, we're not going to make it into Switzerland or a lot of other countries one could think of. And the question is, what is an acceptable form of government, and do we have the staying power to bring that change about? The president was trying to stiffen us to make that long commitment, but I think the mistakes that the administration has made, most notably not putting enough troops in the country in the first place to bring about peace in a way that might give people confidence that the future was going to be better. I think he would have been better off to admit at least some mistakes, but that's not in his character.
No admissions here except for I forget the exact words, but something like the disgraceful actions of a few soldiers at Abu Ghraib. Lawrence Korb, what about the substance of the structure that the U.S. and now U.N. Are headed toward here? There was a great call for the president to come forward with details tonight of who might populate this new Iraqi government. There was absolutely nothing on that front, but he did reiterate the naming of a caretaker government, a transitional government in January, a kind of national assembly to write a new Iraqi constitution, and elections for permanent government later on in 2005. Does this look like a workable structure, whatever the contents may be to you?
Well, it could be, but we just don't know, because here you are about 5 weeks ahead of time. We don't know who the this interim or caretaker government is going to be. And remember, we're supposedly giving them a lot of power. We don't even know who they are. We don't know if, in fact, they will be accepted by the Iraqi people or the different factions in Iraq as legitimate. I mean, this is incredible. I mean, you know, here's the United States. We have an election in November for somebody to take power in January. We're a stable country. Here you have, you know, less than 5 weeks. We don't even know who these people are. We don't know if the Ayatollah Sistani is going to agree, as sometimes in the past he hasn't agreed with, you know, recommendations that we've made.
So even at the last minute, even when they're announced.
That's right. I mean, here you have, the clock is ticking here, and we're putting all of our hopes in Mr. Brahimi. What happens if he comes up with something we don't like, and the Ayatollah does? I mean, those questions were still left hanging. We didn't get any more assurance. You know, some people were hoping tonight he would name who the people are and say they've been blessed by, you know, the various factions, and then we could go on.
Still a lot of presumption in the president tonight that the country will buy the basic vision, even when the blanks are not filled in. Madoffer is calling from Westwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Madoffer. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
First, I am an Iraqi myself. I follow Saddam Hussein. Now I am an American as well, so I might be able to speak both sides. But
okay.
I just need to be heard, please.
What did you hear tonight in the president's speech, Madoffer?
The same things with George Bush, that he defined things the way it's not in any person mind or in any language I can understand. I mean, sovereignty defined, I couldn't find the definition of sovereignty by George Bush in any dictionary except his mind. So,
well, he said tonight, full sovereignty, his phrase.
Which is not true totally, because I read the details of the sovereignty first. The occupation is still there, of the power of more than 130,000 soldiers. They have the command and the American command. And second, each ministry of the what's so-called the new government, it's basically has an American advisor.
We did have the Wall Street Journal reporter who reported in detail on that kind of substructure of American interest and influence that will be there. But Madoffer, let me ask you this. The
yes.
president, he is standing up tonight and saying, we will stand for Iraqi freedom. We'll stick with the Iraqis as long as necessary to make this happen. Is this in no way comforting to you?
No, sir, for so many reasons. I mean, the policy of occupation is against freedom. This is the first contrary of freedom.
It's not there to be occupiers. It's there to be liberators, to work toward freedom. Do you not buy that at all?
I don't buy it, and the Iraqi people don't buy it. I called my friends back home, and they are mostly educated people, teachers, engineers, you name it. And they all know very well what the intention of George Bush. And George Bush himself is not credible for all the Middle Eastern region because his kind of a blind support to Sharon and his slaughter to the Palestinians.
Madoffer, we've got it. Let us pick it up. Our time is short. But E.J. Dionne, what about that? What if the president's speech works with his base and with some margin beyond his base in the United States, but is essentially unconvincing in Iraq itself?
No, I was trying to think about that as I was watching the speech as well, and I think it was a mistake not to say anything at all about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where I think that's very important not only to a lot of people in Iraq, but also to a lot of people in the Arab world, as well as to a lot of Americans, and he said nothing about that. I mean, to go to your caller's point, I think most people in Iraq and here think that the fall of Saddam Hussein is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether we can deliver on promises to transform Iraq in ways that are hopeful, to use a word the president kept using. And I think a lot of the questions Americans have about the president's policy are not related to ideology or even to big geostrategic issues. They just want to know, why didn't this work as well as the administration promised it would work? And I think the question that he didn't answer that the administration hasn't answered is, why did they have this extraordinarily optimistic view that we would be greeted as liberators and everything would go well? It always struck me that it was perfectly possible that a lot of Iraqis would be very glad to be rid of Saddam Hussein, but would not necessarily welcome us to stay there for a long time. And it just doesn't seem to me, at least as one citizen, that the president answered why things haven't gone the way the administration promised.
Lawrence Korb, with that question hanging there, is there room for the Democratic challenger, John Kerry, to come in with an alternate logic, an alternate view, or is he essentially stuck? He hasn't been very vocal on this, but is he stuck, now that the president is going to work with the UN one way or another, is he stuck with a kind of version of what President Bush is putting forward?
Yeah, he's in a tough spot because he voted for the war and he has urged more internationalization. So the president is saying, you know, they introduced a new UN resolution, so it's going to be tough for him to criticize this. I think the one thing he might say is the president was a little sleight of hand there about more troops. Actually, we're keeping the same number. He said we were going to go down, but we're going to keep, you know, they requested to keep it 135. Well, you know, that really is not up. That's what we have now. And I think Kerry might say you're going to need more to deal with, you know, the problems that you have now.
But more troops sounds like something essentially in the service of an agenda like the president's.
In many ways it is. I mean, because, and I think whether it's Kerry or, you know, whoever, I mean, even people who didn't support it don't think you can walk away now, because if you do, you could have a civil war there, and you could also, then it could really become the haven for terrorists that the president was talking about.
DJ Dion, we just have half a minute left. Do you see room for John Kerry to put forth a powerful counter logic or alternate logic that would lead to different policies that might lead to his election?
Well, first of all, I always think back to Dwight Eisenhower, who criticized Harry Truman's policies on Korea, and then his whole alternative policy was, I will go to Korea. So I'm not sure that this election is primarily about John Kerry's alternative. I think it's primarily about the judgment Americans make about how President Bush has handled Iraq. Having said that, it is a high-risk strategy to offer an alternative. It's possible to talk in general terms about we need more allies, we need more UN-NATO support. I have been intrigued by an idea by a friend, Jim Steinberg, at the Brookings Institution, that we ought to declare that in 18 months, by the end of 2005, we will be out of there.
One way or another,
and that might clarify things, and that might actually create incentives in Iraq for Iraqis to move in ways that might be helpful to us, because I don't think Americans want to stay there.
And with that, we're out of time. E.J. Dionne and Lawrence Korb, thank you so much to both of you for being with us tonight.
Thank you
for having us, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.